on this episode of Skeptico.
This is Sam Parnia's study. Why don't you reference the paper? It's Sam Parnia's study. It's a continuation of two or three studies they've done before. And their conclusion, Parnia's conclusion, is that it appears that consciousness survives death from every way that we've measured it. So you're just coming to a completely different conclusion than the researcher did. There's no kind of trick in that. You can just read the research and say, well, I just disagree, without giving any reason for why you disagree.
You know, we all want this to be true. I would like there to be life after death.
I don't care if it's true or not.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that I do care. I think that people do care. I think that as a good scientist, we should understand what our cognitive biases are. And I think that the people who say that there isn't life after death are being a little bit more honest. They're accepting the truth, even though it flies in the face of what they would like to believe.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today's episode is a show that I know a lot of people are not going to like. I know that because whenever I do these shows with leading top mainstream scientists and I push them a little bit, I always get reactions from folks who go, you know, gee, it's too confrontational. Why do you do those kind of shows? Or people say, why do you even bother to talk to those people? They're so close-minded and dogmatic. But I do it, and I'm going to continue to do it for a couple of reasons. First, this is the mainstream voice of science. I think it's easy for those of us more on the alternative science, fringe science, if you want to call it that, side, to get in this echo chamber and imagine that the world is really turning in our favor and that we're winning hearts and minds. And it's good every once in a while to check into the main top dogs of science who, as this interview gives evidence to, are singing the same old song. And the second reason, kind of related to that, that I like to do it, is that I think we need to hold a mirror up to those folks. I think we need to take the research, the good science, from the good scientists that we talk so much about on this show, and hold it up to these folks and really hold them accountable to what they're saying in light of the newest, best, most important research. And that's what I tried to do with today's guest, Dr. Sean Carroll, who is a very highly regarded, well-respected scientist in those circles, does all the TV appearances, will do a lot more major interviews than this little one he's done on Skeptico. And as you hear, is not budging from the party line. So there's a couple things I want to do with this interview. First, I want to give you the interview as it was recorded. And I want to do that because, one, it's only fair to Dr. Carroll and to his book. He was, after all, gracious enough, willing enough to come on this show, which very few of these people are really willing to do once they find out that I'm going to really push them. And as you know, a lot of them just never bother to do the research before they come on, and that's the only reason they come on. But I suspect that Dr. Carroll was aware of the kind of questioning that he was going to get, and he came on anyway, and I really tip my hat to him for that. That takes guts, and I admire that. So I'm going to play this interview basically unedited. I don't think I touched any of the things that he said, and I only corrected a couple places where I stumbled, but it's basically unedited. Then what I want to do is offer a more extended analysis of this interview. And the reason I feel a need to really do that is Sean dishes up so many of the classic misdirects, misinformation, sloppy thinking, and just darn right mistakes many, if not most, of the folks listening to this show. Maybe you can actually do this as a little test for yourself. See how many of those little tricks you can pick up before we analyze it and tear it apart at the end. Of course, if you're solidly in the mind equals brain camp and you insist that you're a biological robot, if you're one of those folks, well, then you'll certainly probably want to skip over that analysis after the interview, but at least you can listen to Dr. Carol unedited. And I offer that to you right now. Dr. Sean Carroll is a Harvard-trained Caltech theoretical physicist with a long list of fellowships, awards, and best-selling books. And he's not only a brilliant scientist, but with his numerous television and movie appearances, well, he's a bit of a science celebrity as well. So we're really fortunate to have Sean here today to talk about his new book, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself. Sean, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
So on this show, we spend a lot of time talking about consciousness science and its direct implications for cosmology, theoretical physics, and science in general. So it's really nice to have a real theoretical physicist on to tackle some of these issues. Can you start by telling us a little bit about your story and, in particular, how you came to write this latest book, The Big Picture?
Yeah, this book is a little bit different than others that I've written, a little bit more ambitious. I mean, it's about a very, very big picture, and the book itself ends up being rather long and covering a lot of stuff. But it reflects interest that I've had, you know, for basically my whole life. I was one of those kids who got interested in science very young, about 10 years old. I became convinced that what I really wanted to do in life was become a theoretical physicist, even though I had no idea what that meant at the time.
Wow.
But then, you know, as early as I was an undergraduate, I was still, you know, following that path. But then I discovered philosophy as well. And I got a philosophy minor as an undergraduate. And then in graduate school, I began to discover how interesting things like evolutionary biology and information theory were and things like that. And this book lets me bring it all together. You know, I talk about philosophy and physics and science and religion and evolution and complexity theory. And then I go all the way to, you know, why we're here and what the purpose of it all is.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is great about the book is you do take this very broad scope. And in particular, what I liked is you spend a lot of time talking about this topic of consciousness, which is the main focus of this show. So can we focus maybe on initially on part five of your book, Thinking? And
sure.
Do you want to lay out the basic premise of your thinking about thinking?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that part five of the six parts in the book, so it's near the end. And the point of the book is there's basically two ideas that I want to get across. One is that the universe is natural. It's basically an apologia for philosophical naturalism, the idea that there is only one world, the natural world, the one that we discover through the methods of science. There's no extra supernatural realm or anything like that. And then secondly, and that's okay. You know, we shouldn't feel anxiety or existential dread about this. You know, the removal of an external purpose is not the end of the meaningfulness of our lives. So in the section on consciousness, I talk a lot about consciousness, but I don't actually talk a lot about this or that particular theory of what consciousness is or how it works. My goal in the section is simply to say there's nothing that we know about consciousness or are likely to learn about it that would lead us to doubt the idea that it is a phenomenon that emerges from the natural workings of the stuff, the forces and particles and energy in our brains, the actual physical stuff that makes us up. I talk about the hard problem and, you know, how we can be experiencing things as well as functioning in the world. And then I try to make the argument that when we talk about being conscious or having an awareness of something, experiencing the redness of red, that is a way of talking about ordinary physical stuff in the universe.
Right. And that really gets to the crux of it. I think it's so interesting. And you do a beautiful job of laying out your case that the world is natural and that's okay. But what always strikes me about these mind equal brain philosophies is how they depart rather radically from the day-to-day, minute-by-minute experience that most of us have. I mean, I'm not a religious person, but when I look at my wife, when I look at my four kids, I feel real meaning, real love and connection, not just the illusion of it, or not just a way of talking about my experience. Do you really believe that all human experience can be reduced to just chemical reactions in our brain?
Yeah, except I wouldn't use the word just, and I wouldn't even use the word reduced, and I certainly wouldn't use the word illusion. And I think that the temptation to use those words is a wonderful reflection of the fact that we're caught in a certain way of thinking about these issues, which I think is outdated. And that's why, you know, this section on thinking in my book appears at the end of, you know, four long sections on physics and philosophy and biology, because I try to sort of build up an enormously compelling case. I mean, it's not my case, the case that scientists and thinkers have put together over the past 500 years, that the world is natural, that there are laws of physics that are obeyed by everything that we're made of, and there's enormously large evidence that there are no violations of those laws of physics, even in thinking human beings. So then the presumption should be enormously big, even before we start thinking about consciousness, that the atoms that make up our brains act the same as atoms that make up, you know, puddles of water or tables or chairs or stars or moons or anything like that. So one of the themes of this very long discussion is that the different ways that we have of talking about the world, from the level of the most microscopic and fundamentally physical to the most emergent and macroscopic and everyday, number one, are very different from each other. The way that we talk about tables and chairs is enormously different than the way we talk about quantum field theory. But number two, they're compatible with each other. They're two related ways of talking about the same underlying stuff. And number three, neither one is an illusion or real. You know, they're both real. That we can talk about tables and chairs, and there's no sensible idea that, you know, a table is an illusion because really it's made out of vibrating quantum fields. I think that's a sort of useless, silly, misguided way of talking. And consciousness is exactly the same way. You know, the feeling that you have for a person you're in love with, or the feeling that you have in a particularly emotional moment, those feelings are absolutely real, and they are also absolutely compatible with a bunch of atoms in your brains obeying the laws of physics.
Okay, but Sean, hold on. Let's first hone in on that. In the big picture, you say meaning, morality, and purpose aren't built into the architecture of the universe. They emerge as a way of talking about our human scale environment. So we can get into emergence and consciousness being an emergent property of the brain in a minute. I think it falls apart. We don't have any other emergent properties that we see in nature that we can't, where we don't understand the constituent elements. I mean, if we're talking about the emergence of a sand dune, we know what it's made up of. In consciousness, it's not like that. But if I was just to get back to what you're really saying there, you're saying that these things are not built into the architecture of the universe. So aren't you kind of doing a flip then when you're saying, oh yeah, but they're really real in some way we don't understand?
Yeah, by built into the architecture of the universe, what I mean is that there are ways of talking about the universe that are by themselves completely coherent and internally consistent and complete, that don't refer to things like consciousness or thoughts or experiences or anything like that. There are other ways of talking about them that do refer to that. And I think it's exactly the same thing as tables and chairs. Tables and chairs are not built into the fundamental architecture of the universe either, but they're a very, very convenient way of conceptualizing the universe at certain scales. And I'm just saying exactly the same thing about consciousness.
Yeah, I'm not so sure on the emergent idea that it to me, it always strikes me like the old joke, give me one miracle and I can explain the rest. I mean, the idea that consciousness is an emergent property of the brain is convenient to deal with the problems that we see in the mind-body problem in terms of the physicalism that used to be so popular in terms of talking about consciousness. I'm just not sure it really adds up. But I'll tell you, let's leave that aside because we're probably getting in too deep there. I'd return to a point that you had earlier about this, essentially about this burden of proof. And I understand where you're coming from saying, hey, there's this huge body of scientific evidence that suggests that this is the way that the world is, that physicalism, mind equal brain, naturalism is the way that the world is. But I think you kind of sneak in some references that kind of stretch that point. I mean, you talk about Buddhism having traces of it. It has this long distinguished pedigree, and that philosophers in ancient Greece and Rome and even Confucius. I mean, Buddha didn't believe that mind equals brain. Plato didn't. Confucius was, he was kind of mainly a secular ethicist, but he was embedded in a culture that was completely convinced that consciousness survives death. So is it really fair to say that this naturalism idea is so popular in terms of all the great thinkers throughout time?
Oh, I think that naturalism has never been popular until sort of modern secular societies, but there's always been strands of it. The good news is that we know a lot more about the universe than Buddha or Plato did. We can say a lot more accurate things about it. So I would never say that the primary theme of ancient Greek philosophy or Buddhist philosophy or Confucianism was naturalist in its outlook. But there were always people, even in those cultures, that did go for naturalism, that they, you know, took a more flinty-eyed, hard-edged, take-the-universe-seriously kind of point of view, and they realized that you didn't need all this extra superstructure of extra planes of existence or anything like that. We're most familiar with those strains in ancient Greece and Rome, people like Epicurus and Democritus and Leucippus and Lucretius, but I just wanted to make the point that they were also there in ancient China, in ancient India, all around the world.
Right. Still, say I think they were embedded in cultures that completely rejected the idea, and they were maybe playing on the edges. But hey, I get your point. Let's switch over.
Yeah, I mean, we're embedded in a culture that is going to have Donald Trump as one of its major presidential candidates. So I think that, you know, it's important to distinguish between the sort of minority views in the culture and the wider context in which they're embedded.
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, you are certainly in the minority view. This idea that we're biological robots in a meaningless universe and that the only meaning is from this way that we talk about this social construct of consciousness is a vastly, vastly unpopular. I mean, 90% of people when they're polled do not believe in that, believe that there is a greater meaning to life. So, I mean, popularity is kind of cuts both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And it depends very much on which group of people you're asking. People have actually made these questions to professional philosophers, for example, where it is clear that the point of views that I'm advocating in this book are the majority point of view. Like one of the very, very, very few things that more than two-thirds of philosophers agree on, they tend not to agree with each other very much. One of the very few things they agree on is in naturalism, in that, you know, there's one world, the natural world. It's no doubt that this view has not yet percolated out into the wider culture. That's why I've written the book.
Let's move on and talk about neuroscience, because you do talk a little bit about neuroscience in the book. I'm not a big fan of panpsychism, this idea that everything in the universe has a little bit of this consciousness stuff in it. But even some of the world's leading neuroscientists, like former colleague of yours at Caltech and a former guest on the show, Dr. Christoph Koch, has had to acknowledge that we need something like panpsychism to explain consciousness. I mean, this is really where cutting-edge neuroscience really is saying, no, we need to move beyond naturalism and look for a little bit something more to explain consciousness, isn't it?
Well, we have to be, you know, at this level, we need to sort of be very, very careful about all the labels because they begin to become very fine-grained. So people like David Chalmers, Christoph Koch, Giulio Tononi, these are people who thought very, very deeply about neuroscience and consciousness. They are sympathetic to panpsychism, the idea that there's a bit of consciousness in everything, even in, you know, individual elementary particles, but they're also thoroughgoing naturalists. They would be classified as naturalists, but not physicalists. So there's only one world, the natural world, but they think that mental properties are an intrinsic part of reality over and above the physical properties of matter. So that is, within this community, a minority point of view also. So there, I give them credit in the book for sort of the courage of their convictions. You know, if you want to dive into this way of thinking about the world, you have to say that even electrons have a little bit of consciousness. And I try to make the point in the book that, no, they don't. There's very, very good reasons to think that electrons have no consciousness at all. But, you know, I take them very, very seriously as careful intellectual thinkers. They're, you know, advocating a certain point of view, and they're comfortable accepting the consequences of that point of view. I think that the data and our experience are much better fit by a purely physical point of view that says that consciousness is more like wetness. It's something that is a good way of talking about the world at a remove, at a sort of coarse-grained version of macroscopic reality that is simply not there, simply not a useful way of thinking about things when you look at microscopic particles.
Okay, well, in that same section then, and picking up on the point you just made, you have a line in there that caught my attention. You say, unlike brains, which are complicated and hard to explain, elementary particles are extraordinarily simple. And what I immediately thought of was one of the most famous and mysterious quantum physics experiments of all times, the double slit experiment. And you kind of make reference to this in the book, where they shoot this beam of photons through two tiny holes and to see whether they act as waves or particles. And as you know, this has been a long time debate among quantum physicists as to what we're really measuring there. What I thought about was this recently published research by Dr. Dean Radin, published in a peer-reviewed journal in 2012, and it finally, and really quite convincingly, with a p-value of something like 10 to the minus sixth or something, shows that consciousness, that is a human being that was instructed to focus on that photon beam, can actually collapse the quantum wave function. So this is kind of one of the core fundamental questions we've had about consciousness. And it seems to be answered in a way that moves us away from your mind equals brain physicalism.
Yeah, I think that's just not right. I think that that is not something that, 99.9% of working physicists would say is actually true.
Published in Physics Essays 2012, peer-reviewed, has anyone else done this experiment and shown it not to be true? Not that I'm aware of.
Well, not that I'm aware of specifically. I don't think anyone would really spend the time and money to do it,
Why not? Why not? It's a relatively simple experiment, right?
A lot of stuff that appears in peer-reviewed journals that is not right. As someone who is refereeing for these journals and reading them, the standard for accepting some enormously dramatic overthrow of the laws of nature as we know them is much higher than someone got an article in a peer-reviewed journal.
But Sean, this wouldn't be a radical overthrow. 100 years ago, this was the conclusion that quantum physicists, at least half of them, came to, is that consciousness seems to be collapsing the wave function. So it's not like it's a radical idea. We just stepped over it and say, let's do shut up and calculate. Let's just see how we can use these ideas rather than worry about the philosophical implications. But it's not like these guys disagreed with the idea that consciousness can collapse the wave function, is it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there was never any consensus that consciousness was involved in collapsing the wave function. There were people who suggested it. There were, we certainly don't claim to have the final understanding of what really does happen when wave functions collapse. I mean, that's a very good question.
Right, but didn't the biggest names, Niels Bohr and Schrodinger and all these people came to the conclusion that it seems like consciousness is collapsing the wave function. So you can say there wasn't a consensus, sure, but there were some pretty heavy hitters on that side.
No, that's not at all true. What people like Schrodinger and Bohr were suggesting, actually not even Schrodinger, he was skeptical about the whole thing, but Bohr and Heisenberg, the founders of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, they were saying that what we think of as the wave function isn't a physically real thing. It's a way of calculating what we measure. So it's not that consciousness in some philosophical sense has anything to do with collapsing the wave function. It's just that what the wave function is a calculational tool for physicists to use. Now, again, this is sort of gone away for the most part as we understand more and more about how physics works. It's still possible. We need to be very, very careful about what we do and don't understand. This idea of what we call an epistemic approach to quantum mechanics, where we treat the wave function as a calculational tool rather than an element of reality, it's very much on the table. It's something that is really real. But we understand so much more about decoherence, about the evolution of wave functions, about small-scale quantum phenomena, that the idea that human consciousness plays a role that would not be, for example, played by a video camera or a microscope is something that almost no working physicists actually hold.
Again, I'd refer you to Dean Radin's paper, and I don't think we're going to agree on Niels Bohr and Heisenberg, but I'm actually doing a show on what those folks really believed, and listeners of the show will maybe have a chance to revisit that. I appreciate where you're coming from. Let's talk about a more concrete example. In chapter 27 of The Big Picture, which is titled Death is the End, with the emphasis on is, I looked at this chapter when I was reviewing the table of contents, and I was really anxious to dig into it because I was sure you were going to talk about near-death experience science. I wanted to hear your take on it. As you know, in the last 25 years, there's been an explosion of interest in the phenomenon, and it's become a very hot topic of medical research. But you don't reference any of that research. Why?
Well, I reference it very glancingly. It's very, very little, because the entire point I'm trying to make is that it's almost unfair to take the standards that we are subjected to in that area of research and put it up against modern physics and science in any way. You know, there's been enormously strong evidence from all that we understand about matter and energy and consciousness and so forth on one side that says that when you die, there's just no way for the information that is contained in your brain to persist in anything outside the brain. And then there are these claims, on the other hand, from near-death experiences that are just enormously unconvincing in every way, in terms of scientific protocols, in terms of what we interpret the evidence to say, and so forth. So the way that I like to say it is you basically have two choices. One choice is to say that, you know, in contrast with every experiment ever done in the history of careful modern science, there is some way that some ill-defined metaphysical process is able to continue on the information that we have in our brains even after our physical bodies start working, or people hallucinate when they're nearly dead. And I think that, you know, as a good Bayesian, as I say in the book, the probabilities favor very, very heavily the idea that near-death experiences are people hallucinating when they're really dead. Nearly dead.
But Sean, what you're doing is just simply ignoring hundreds of peer-reviewed papers, some of them in the top medical journals in the world. So, you know, I hear this and I'm reminded of the story that one of those researchers, a longtime, highly regarded cardiologist, Dr. Pin Van Lommel, tells about when he was asked to present his findings at a medical conference. So he stands up, he gives his presentation, he says, look, I've been doing this research into near-death experience for 20 years, not because I wanted to, but because it came up as part of my practice as a cardiologist, and I felt like it was irresponsible not to follow this. I've come to the conclusion, as every near-death experience researcher that I can think of, that in some way we don't understand consciousness survives death. That's his conclusion. And a doctor from the audience stands up and says, hey, I've been a cardiologist for 25 years, and I've never heard a single story like this from any of my patients. And then this woman from the audience stands up and says, well, I'm a patient of yours. I've had a near-death experience. And the reason I never told you about it is because I thought you would never listen. Is it possible that that's kind of what you're doing? You're not really digging into the evidence? I mean, there have been hundreds of these papers, and they're all coming to just about the same conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, anything is possible. I think it's very, very important as scientists to never set our credence in any one possibility all the way to zero. So I definitely think that if your criteria is it possible, then yeah, absolutely. This is very possible. My point is that what we're putting against each other are really, really rigorous, carefully controlled scientific studies that tell us how matter and energy work in the world versus these nowhere near carefully controlled stories that people tell about what they remember after they were nearly dead. That's the definition of a near-death experience. And what we know from neuroscience is that when you're nearly dead, all sorts of signals are bouncing around inside your brain that can feel extremely real to you once you wake up. So you look into these studies that have been done and you find, oh, that one actually didn't say what it said. This one was not done under controlled experiences. This one was just a blatant fake and so forth. And at some point you say, I'm not going to spend any more time thinking about this.
But Sean, these generalities are not supported at all in anything you've published in the book. And I don't see it in anything you've published anywhere else. Share with us some of the studies that you think do not live up to that standard. Tell us whether Pin Van Lommel did. Tell us whether Dr. Sam Parnia, who just published in Resuscitation, a long-term 25-year study with, maybe not 25, it's like 10 years in 20 different hospitals. Do these not live up to these standards? I mean, I think just to say that without having any way of backing it up is, I don't know. I just find that very surprising. Tell us what studies you think don't hold up to those criteria.
You know, life is short. You have to pick what I could spend my entire life reading studies on near-death experiences and carefully understanding why they're flawed. And I got no interest in that because once you see a couple, you know, I debated Eben Alexander at the Intelligence Squared Debates in New York City. And it's perfectly clear that, you know, he's made millions of dollars selling a best-selling book because he told a little story. There's no evidence. There's no anything like a scientifically controlled thing. I do reference in the book an attempt to do a scientifically controlled study. People put pieces of paper in the hospital rooms of terminal patients that were very, very ill, very close to death, and they put them in places where you wouldn't be able to see them.
This is Sam Parnia's study. Why don't you reference the paper? It's Sam Parnia's study. It's a continuation of two or three studies they've done before, and their conclusion, Parnia's conclusion, is that it appears that consciousness survives death from every way that we've measured it. So you're just coming to a completely different conclusion than the researcher did. There's no kind of trick in that. You can just read the research and say, well, I just disagree without giving any reason for why you disagree.
You know, we all want this to be true. I would like there to be life after death.
I don't care if it's true or not.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that I do care. I think that people do care. I think that as a good scientist, we should understand what our cognitive biases are. And I think that the people who say that there isn't life after death are being a little bit more honest. They're accepting the truth, even though it flies in the face of what they would like to believe.
That is always a kind of strange conclusion to come to, an argument to make. Couldn't someone make exactly the opposite conclusion? If I know there's nothing after death, I could find comfort in that. I don't have to worry about these crazy ideas about hell and demons ripping my body apart. I don't have to really worry about anything. So, I mean, from a philosophical standpoint, I don't know that argument really holds up one way or another.
Well, I think you will find that the very large majority of people who believe in life after death do not believe that they are the ones who are going to hell and being ripped up by the demons. They tend to think that they're going to be rewarded afterward.
Well, the other point that we have to consider is that people throughout time and throughout cultures across the world have all had these experiences, these direct experiences that make them believe that there is a continuity to life after death. I mean, that's what we're really dealing with, and that's what the near-death experience research is dealing with. It didn't just grow out of nothing. It came out of the experiences of people that need to be investigated further. But you know what? I think we've hammered that point maybe to the ground. Tell us, you've told us the two main points that you want people to get out of the big picture, that it's all natural and that's okay. How is that playing to your audience? Is that message getting through? This has been a message that's been around for a while. It's kind of wrapped up into the new atheist movement in some ways. Do you see that message gaining force, gaining momentum?
I think so. I mean, I don't really necessarily have an idea of what my audience is. I'm hoping to reach a lot of different people. I try very hard to be respectful of people who disagree with me. I'm not one of these people who thinks that there's anything to be gained by going around and talking about the people who I disagree with as idiots or deluded or, you know, mental torture or anything like that. I think that the universe is much bigger than all of us. The mysteries of the universe are very hard, and we deserve mutual respect as we try to figure out what is happening in the universe. And I think that the case I try to make is that as we learn more and more about how the universe works, our opinions about how it works are changing. Our beliefs, our credences in the different possible ways of thinking about the cosmos are naturally changing in response to better and better understanding. And like you said, the idea, for example, that there is persistence of the soul after death is one that has always been part of human culture. And now it is diminishing. The number of, the fraction of people who believe in that is decreasing as the scientific evidence is pointing against it.
Maybe I think, again, that depends on how you phrase the question, but that's the problem with surveys. I'll tell you what, I think you do a fantastic job of making your points and making your case. It's an extremely well-written book that I think people will enjoy reading and hearing that point of view. Again, our guest has been Sean Carroll, Dr. Sean Carroll. The book is The Big Picture on the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe. Thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Carroll.
Sure. Thanks, Alex. My pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Sean Carroll for joining me on Skeptico. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I do have some closing remarks / analysis that I wanted to offer for the interview. So if you don't want to hear that, if you just want to be left with the soothing, comforting, or not so comforting words of Dr. Carroll, then end this thing now and turn it off and you're safe. But if you do want to play along with me this little game where we analyze and break down what's been said, then hey, stick with me. And like I said, we will turn it into a little game here. I'm going to play clips from the show and then I'll pause a little bit and we'll see if you can figure out what's really at play. And then I'll offer up my analysis of what I think is really going on with some of these very nuanced treatments of the truth. Now, I have to say, because I said it in the show, you know, he does a good job of presenting his case. And one of the reasons I feel a need to do this kind of analysis is that it's kind of hard to wade through what he's saying because he does make it sound so good, so logical. But let's dig into it and see if it really holds up. So let me start with this clip. Do you really believe that all human experience can be reduced to just chemical reactions in our brain?
Yeah, except I wouldn't use the word just. And I wouldn't even use the word reduced, and I certainly wouldn't use the word illusion.
Okay, so what's going on here? I'll pause and give you a minute to consider it, to really formulate your answer. So the first thing to notice is that I hit this guy over the head with biological robot in a meaningless universe. I said that a bunch of times. He never pushed back, notice. He never said, no, we're not biological robots. No, the universe isn't meaningless. He never pushed back. What he's doing here is trying to do something very slippery. Notice I say, can everything that we experience be reduced to a chemical reaction in your brain? What's his first answer? Yes, but... And here's the but that he tries to work in there. But I wouldn't say just. What do you mean you wouldn't say just? And here is the trick. Here's the latest ploy that the materialists are trying to hold on to. You know, 10 years ago, or definitely 20 years ago, what they just said was what Daniel Dennett still says, is consciousness is an illusion. There is no such thing as human experience. Just get over it. And then they realize that that doesn't really sell. One, it's just absurd. It's just a crazy idea to go and tell someone that everything about their minute-to-minute experience, everything that they hold most dearly in their life, is an illusion. Hey, that does not sell. And these guys have realized that, so they've changed the message. And they've said, no, your experience is this wonderful way that we have of talking about this complex emergent property that happens inside of your brain. But would we really get down to it? Is it all just inside your brain? Is it all just a chemical reaction? Yes. Oh, but it's really quite special and all the rest of this they're going to attach to it. Well, that's just bullshit. If you look at what Sean Carroll is saying, he's saying that purpose and meaning is a social construct. is a way we have of talking about all the complexity that's going on in your brain. This is a huge metaphysical assumption. He doesn't have any proof of this. He can't say when consciousness begins, when it ends, what's necessary or sufficient to cause consciousness, yet he wants you to accept his metaphysics. That is that consciousness is totally a result of your brain. And the reason he has to is because he has to back into his cosmology, which is that he's certain that the universe has no meaning. So be clear, and I've said this before, but think this through. This is logic 101, but it blows past most of us. It did me for years. And that is, if the universe is meaningless, and you are embedded in that meaningless universe, then there can be no meaning to you, to your life. It can't be any other way. If there's meaning in your life, then there's meaning in the universe. If the universe is meaningless, then your life is meaningless. But again, this is not something he can sell. He knows this isn't going to fly. So he's putting up this elaborate smokescreen. Hey, is the entirety of human experience just a chemical reaction in your brain? Yes, but... Okay, so score yourself a point if you caught that one. I think you could deserve extra credit, double points, if you caught that one, because it's really a hard one to catch. At least it was hard for me to catch it for a long, long time. Okay, next point. Is it really fair to say that this naturalism idea is so popular in terms of all the great thinkers throughout time?
Oh, I think that naturalism has never been popular until sort of modern secular societies, but there's always been strands of it. The good news is that we know a lot more about the universe than Buddha or Plato did. We can say a lot more accurate things about it.
Okay, again, let me pause for a minute and make sure you've sorted out your answer to this one. What's really going on here? You know, I have to say, first off, this is almost a throwaway point. I mean, authors like this like to kind of bullshit and stretch the truth a little bit. And I guess some of that is okay. It just kind of irks me when a guy says in his book, there is a long distinguished pedigree for the kind of reductionistic physicalism that I'm talking about here. And then he cites Buddha and he cites Plato and he cites Confucius. He's trying to suck you in. He's trying to wrap himself with some historical celebrity here. You feel good about Buddha. You feel good about Plato. You feel good about Confucius. So let me tie my idea to them. Again, it's just bullshit, though, as I mentioned. The ideas of Buddhism are completely contrary to this reductionistic biological robot meaningless universe thing. There's no connection at all. Those ideas wouldn't make any sense to any Buddhist or to Plato or any of the Greek or Roman philosophers or to Confucius. The fact is that no culture throughout time, throughout history, has ever bought into this ridiculous mind equal brain silliness. Except our current flavor of atheistic science, that is, science as we know it. Okay, minor point. Let's move on to something more substantial. You have a line in there that caught my attention. You say, unlike brains, which are complicated and hard to explain, elementary particles are extraordinarily simple. And what I immediately thought of was one of the most famous and mysterious quantum physics experiments of all times, the double slit experiment. And you kind of make reference to this in the book, where they shoot this beam of photons through two tiny holes and to see whether they act as waves or particles. And as you know, this has been a long time debate among quantum physicists as to what we're really measuring there. What I thought about was this recently published research by Dr. Dean Radin, published in a peer-reviewed journal in 2012, and it finally, and really quite convincingly, with a p-value of something like 10 to the minus 6th or something, shows that consciousness, that is a human being that was instructed to focus on that photon beam, can actually collapse the quantum wave function. So this is kind of one of the core fundamental questions we've had about consciousness. And it seems to be answered in a way that moves us away from your mind equals brain physicalism.
Yeah, I think that's just not right. I think that that is not something that, you know, 99.9% of working physicists would say is actually true.
Published in Physics Essays 2012, peer-reviewed, has anyone else done this experiment and shown it not to be true? Not that I'm aware of.
Well, not that I'm aware of specifically. I don't think anyone would really spend the time and money to do it, you know.
Why not? Why not? It's a relatively simple experiment, right?
A lot of stuff that appears in peer-reviewed journals that is not right. You know, as someone who is refereeing for these journals and reading them, the standard for accepting some enormously dramatic overthrow of the laws of nature as we know them is much higher than someone got an article in a peer-reviewed journal.
Okay, what do you think? Did you catch that one? This one would be simple, except that he's stacked a bunch of nincompoopery together to kind of add an extra layer of confusion. First, he's doing the famous, I wouldn't believe it even if it was true kind of thing, right? Where he's saying, hey, here's this research. What about this research? Well, I don't know anything about that research, but I'm sure it's not true. Sean, I hate to tell you, you're the Harvard physicist, you're the Caltech professor, but that's not how science works. You got to look at the data before you say something's not true. Then he pulls out a couple other tricks. First, he says, peer review doesn't mean anything. But then you notice he kind of backs off because he starts to say, hey, I sit on the editorial board of these journals and I'm a peer reviewer. And then he realizes where this is leading. So, Sean, you're saying peer review doesn't mean anything and you're one of the peers? So he just kind of backs off of that. And then he adds in the other punch that we've heard so many times. You know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proofs, he's saying. Oh, but, you know, something that would totally overturn everything we know about science, which in this case is completely ridiculous because, as we talk about later, this is an experiment that has been contemplated and looked at for 100 years. It's been debated. There's two sides of the debate. Yet, he's going to take the position, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. So, there's 3 points available for this one. Did you get all 3? The first is, I wouldn't believe it even if it was true. Second is, peer review doesn't mean anything. And third is, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. It's all pretty standard stuff, but it came at you pretty fast, so I would understand if you didn't get all of them. But if you did get all of them, give yourself an extra bonus point on that one, too. Okay, let's move on to the next one. I love history of science, even though I don't know much about it, but apparently I know more than Sean Carroll does. But Sean, this wouldn't be a radical overthrow. 100 years ago, this was the conclusion that quantum physicists, at least half of them, came to.
I mean, there was never any consensus that consciousness was involved in collapsing the wave function.
Right, but didn't the biggest names, I mean, Niels Bohr and Schrodinger and all these people came to the conclusion that it seems like consciousness is collapsing the wave function. So you can say there wasn't a consensus, sure, but there were some pretty heavy hitters on that side.
No, that's not at all true. What people like Schrodinger and Bohr were suggesting, actually not even Schrodinger, he was skeptical about the whole thing, but Bohr and Heisenberg, the founders of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, they were saying that what we think of as the wave function isn't a physically real thing.
Okay, now we move into the bonus round, the deep waters of quantum physics and science history, which I have to admit, he was so confident in saying this that I questioned whether I really knew the tiny bit of history that I thought I knew. Well, it took all of about 90 seconds to find these quotes. The first one from Niels Bohr. We can admittedly find nothing in physics or chemistry that has even remote bearing on consciousness. Yet, all of us know that there is such a thing as consciousness simply because we have it ourselves. Of course. Hence, consciousness must be a part of nature, or more generally, of reality, which means that, quite apart from the laws of physics and chemistry, as laid down in quantum theory, we must also consider laws of quite a different kind. Sean. Crack open a history book now and then. You know, this would all be a lot funnier if it wasn't so tragic. I mean, this is science. This is the science that we have right now. Okay, but what about Schrodinger? I have to say, I wasn't even that sure about Schrodinger. I just know, primarily, I think, through the Skeptical Forum, I had read that he was generally in support of the idea of consciousness. So I did a very quick Google search. Here's what I found from a paper he published in 1958. He argues that there is a difference between measuring instruments and human observation. Right? So that's what this whole thing is about. A thermometer's registration cannot be considered an act of observation as it contains no meaning in and of itself. Again, it's a little bit obscure there, but this is what we're talking about, whether consciousness affects the wave function kind of thing. So then he comes to the conclusion. Here's the exact quote. Some of you, I am sure, call this mysticism. So with all due acknowledgement to the fact that physical theory is at all times relative in that it depends on certain basic assumptions, we may, or so I believe, assert that physical theory in its present stage strongly suggests the indestructibility of mind by time. Yes, the indestructibility of mind by time. Consciousness persists. Okay, like I said, this is the bonus round, so you get double points for Bohr or for Schrodinger if you knew either one of those quotes or the general ideas of them. But let's move on. As I say, this is really outside of my swing zone. But next, we talk about near-death experience, which I do through the benefit of doing all these interviews with all the top researchers, know a little bit more about. Let me remind you how the conversation went with Dr. Carroll. But Sean, these generalities are not supported at all in anything you've published in the book, and I don't see it in anything you've published anywhere else. Share with us some of the studies that you think do not live up to that standard. Tell us whether Pin Van Lommel did. Tell us whether Dr. Sam Parnia, who just published in Resuscitation, a long-term 25-year study, maybe not 25, it was like 10 years in 20 different hospitals. Do these not live up to these standards? I mean, I think just to say that without having any way of backing it up is, I don't know. I just find that very surprising. Tell us what studies you think don't hold up to those criteria.
You know, life is short. You have to pick what. I could spend my entire life reading studies on near-death experiences and carefully understanding why they're flawed, and I got no interest in that.
Okay, this one's going to be tough to score because I don't like giving away free points, and this is a lob here. I mean, here's a guy who's written a book with a whole chapter dedicated to the scientific question of death and that death is the end. And he knows, obviously, that the near-death experience science is out there. But he just ignores it. And then when pressed on it, he pulls the old, I'm a busy scientist, life is short thing. Does anyone fall for this? Let me turn it around. Can you imagine any scientist that you respect? Think of a scientist you respect. Now imagine them saying this about anything, about any scientific question. Well, you know, life is short. I know I've offered an opinion, written a book on the topic, but life is too short to really research, to really understand the evidence that might contradict what I'm saying. Again, I don't think anyone really falls for this unless you're really, really dedicated to holding on to these cherished beliefs that apparently Dr. Carroll is dedicated to holding on to. So I do, in fairness, I'll give you the point on this one, but I don't know if you should even feel good about taking it because this, you got to admit, was a lob. Okay, so that's it. Time to tally up your score. Now, when you have your score, why don't you do this for me? Why don't you share it with me? Send it to me. Post it on the Skeptical Forum. Post it on my Facebook. Send it to me by email. I want to know how you did on this one. Did you get all the points that were allotted? Or did you score, as Dr. Carroll did, a zero on the test? Again, like I said at the opening, a lot of people are not going to like this show. And a lot of people are especially not going to like this analysis at the end of the show. But I do think at some point we have to expose this nincompoopery. And since so many of these people hide, and again, I give him credit for not hiding, for coming out at least facing these tough questions, but since it seems to happen so infrequently, I did want to take this opportunity to really break down this silliness. So again, let me know what you think. The place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to the show if you like, through Stitcher, iTunes, any of those other ways. You can also subscribe to the newsletter where you just get an update on when new episodes come out. And of course, you can download the shows for free and do all that other usual stuff, including the forum and connecting with me. So I do have a number of interesting shows coming up. I'm not exactly sure what the next one will be, but I'm pretty sure it will be 2 weeks from today. I'm back to my every other week publishing schedule unless something changes, which could always happen. But until then, I do appreciate you listening, and I do look forward to hearing your feedback on this show. Do take care, and bye for now.